afternoon. Call to order the House Committee on Rules for Monday, March 11. First order of business is to open a work session for the introduction of possible of committee measures.
Do we have a quorum?
Well, Representative Kenmer was here. There he is.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have LC 3748, which is relating to public safety fiscal emergencies before you today.
Chair, I move that the following LC be introduced as a committee bill, LC 3748, relating to public safety fiscal emergencies.
Representative Barnhart moves that LC 3748 be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Close the work session on introduction of committee measures, and I will open public hearing on House Bill 2351. Ms. Seiler?
2351.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2351 increases filing fee for office of state senator and representative from $25 to $50, requires nominating petition for office of state senator or state representative to contain at least 250 signatures or number of signatures at least equal to 2% of votes cast in electoral district for specified candidates, whichever is less. This measure has a subsequent referral to Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jules Bailey, representing House District 42, and I appreciate you taking the time to hear my perennial bill. Let's see if it gets any traction this time around. House Bill 2351 is a very simple bill, and I will say up front, it is a bill that looks to raise a fee. It's a fee that we pay as candidates for state representative and for state senator, if any of those senators were here. The purpose of this bill is about making it more equal between the two methods of filing for office. Right now, it's $25 to file for state representative, state senator, or 500 signatures. I believe that democracy is about getting out, knocking on doors, and talking to voters, as I believe all of you do as well. But the intersection between 500 signatures verified through that process versus $25 means that it's difficult for especially new candidates to think about how they might approach that daunting task of filing for office through a signature verification method, and it becomes far easier to just default to paying the fee when there is a real value in having folks right out of the gates going out and talking to their constituents in order to get on the ballot. All this bill does is seeks to have a little bit more balance between those two methods. 250 signatures, $50 to file. This is less about raising the fee to file and more about making it easier and more balanced between those two methods to encourage candidates to go out and get the signatures they need to file for office. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
You volunteering to run our campaigns to gather signatures?
Mr. Chair, I'll be busy doing my own. Thank you.
Representative Deborah?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Remind me, Representative, so we also have the ability to waive the voter's pamphlet filing fee through signature. Do the same signatures count for both, or do you need
Chair,
a separate set?
Representative Dembro, my understanding is that they do not, that they are separate.
I think that's right.
And do you have any sense of why that is? I mean, they happen around the same time.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dembro, I actually think that they happen at quite different times, in that one could theoretically submit as early as, I believe, mid-September to file for public office versus a voter's pamphlet statement that is due in March. So I think it's a temporal issue. Would be my speculation, but I don't know.
Right, but I'm just wondering, I mean, if I were out in the fall, and I've done this, but I've never done both at the same time. I did it once for the filing fee, and then I've done it since for the voter's pamphlet. If I'm out collecting signatures in September, October, is there any good reason that those signatures should not be able to continue to count for the voter's pamphlet statement? I suppose the difference is when I'm asking people to sign the voter's pamphlet statement, I actually have to have the voter's pamphlet statement for them to read and to agree with.
Chair Garrett, Representative Dembro, I'm fully open to that being part of the discussion on the bill. It's not something I've spent a lot of time thinking about. I can tell you that, as I'm sure many of you who have filed in this way know, the process of getting 500 signatures is that from registered voters of your party in your district is actually not easy. Even in my district, where I have a very dense neighborhood and easily walkable districts, and not to be glib, but I could practically knock on every door and find voters of my party in my district who could sign. It's challenging, and it took weeks and weeks of campaign of knocking every day, only to get to 500 signatures, actually more, because you need some margin for error, and discover that, in fact, I had used the previous year's form as opposed to the current year's form, and had to start the entire effort over again, and ended up collecting almost 1,500 signatures in total. Now, it was a useful exercise, and those are doors I would have knocked on anyway and talked to folks, but as a prerequisite for filing for candidacy, that's a pretty high bar. It made it much easier the second time around for me just to pay $25 and call it good, and still go out and talk to voters and have town halls and knock on doors, but not have to go through the paperwork of all of those signatures in the verification process. So what this bill does is seeks to just bring those back into alignment. $50, 250 signatures. Let's make it easier for people to go knock on doors and talk to voters.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for bringing us this bill. We have one other person to testify on this. Janice Deisinger, please.
Thank you, Chair Representative Garrett and Vice Chair Representative Hicks and committee members. My name is Janice Deisinger, and I just wanted to quickly say, as I understood the bill, it increases the partisanship of the signatures that are gathered, and it makes it a little more complicated for how the where the signatures are gathered within each location. So I just wanted to make it the most accessible to a candidate to file as we could make it. Some people file late in the session, late in the timeline in order to file. So with those people that come towards the end, I think it should not make it as any more difficult than it needs to be.
Okay. Any questions?
Anybody have any questions?
Thank you. Okay, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 20, what was that? 2351. We'll go in order now and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2199, please. First witnesses will be Tim Scott and Steve Trout and Tim Scott. And Ms. Seiler.
Members, House Bill 2199 modifies requirements of county election security plans to include number and location of any voter of any video cameras located where ballots may be tallied. It requires county clerk at time clerk proclaims results of election to submit to the Secretary of State record of number of ballots. Requires county clerk at end of voting on election day to mark each duplicate ballot and mark or seal secure an account for unused ballots. Requires county clerk as soon as practicable after election to destroy unused ballots. Requires person returning completed ballot for voter to return county clerk by mail to office of county clerk or any designated ballot drop location within 2 days of receiving ballot. There is an emergency clause on this measure. You do have a -1 amendment. -1 amendment clarifies video surveillance cameras are within elections office, clarifies language for report that is to be submitted to the Secretary of State regarding record of ballots at election, and states the county clerk is responsible for safekeeping, disposition, and security for all ballots.
Mr. Trout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Steve Trout, State Election Director, and thanks for the opportunity to come and speak to you about House Bill 2199, our ballot security bill. We like to discuss the -1 amendments, which just offer some clarifying and simplifying language, especially around The video surveillance cameras included everywhere in the election offices, not just where the ballots would be tallied, given some recent developments in Clackamas County. But really, the Dash Ones are here to increase the security and transparency of our election processes with respect to ballots. And it addresses the issue of unused ballots, that there's conflicting language in the statutes, that this last fall went all the way to court in Multnomah County, where the judge agreed that this language is contradictory and needs to be clarified, and that's simply our intent. Our intent is to make sure that ballots are maintain the security of ballots, and an accounting of the ballots is maintained, and that's what this bill does. It adds to the clerks a requirement to report to us, which would be a public document upon certification of the election results, a number of items that we'll provide to the public and to the clerk and to anyone that wants to observe an accounting of the ballot envelopes received, those that are accepted, those aren't accepted, those that are rejected, the number of tallied ballots, and a number of the different categories of things that we go through. It's hard to balance these numbers because every election will have envelopes that come in with no ballots in them, or ballots with love notes written on them, or my personal favorite that I still don't understand, the ballots from the previous election. So that makes it almost impossible to have a 100% rock solid accounting. But through these steps, it will help us to be able to provide an accounting that's able to help the clerks with their certification and to have confidence in those results, and adds more transparency to the public to show that, hey, actually we had this many ballot envelopes returned, there were this many ballots, there were this many rejected, and so we have some data there to support the certification that we don't currently make available to the public. And then the one other addition to the law would be for those places where, for those instances where people are going and picking up ballots, the unofficial drop box, so to speak, it puts a two-day requirement on them to return the ballot within 2 days of them picking them up, to turn that into a drop box or to the county clerk's office, so that we don't have people collecting them a week or 2 weeks before the election and then dumping them on our county clerk at 7:55 on election night, which makes it harder to process and harder for the counties to efficiently administer the election. So those are the highlights, and be happy to answer any questions.
Can you just say again, for background, what the internal contradiction is in the current law that you're trying to resolve?
So it's in 254.483, and I'll just, believe it or not, it's highlighted. So immediately after 8 o'clock on the day of an election, sub one, the county clerk shall destroy all unused absentee and regular ballots in the county clerk's possession. Sub two, each county shall provide for the security of and shall account for unused ballots. So that's the way the law has been for a long time. It's really a remnant of polling place elections. Ever since we went entirely vote by mail back in the year 2000, the current practice of securing and accounting for the ballots, the clerks have chosen to emphasize sub two. In sub one, it talks about unused absentee and regular ballots. There are, I think from my declaration in the lawsuit, I think there's 9 different types of ballots that aren't articulated here: duplicate ballots, provisional ballots, military and overseas ballots. I won't bore you with all the details, but Judge Yu, let me just read some language here. She says, the provisions of ORS 254-483 contradict each other. Here the statutes are so contradictory they are impossible to reconcile, which you know, that's why I've been trying to, you know, clarify this section for two sessions now, just simply as a cleanup measure so that it's clear both to us and to the public of what the requirements are to maintain the security and accounting of the ballots. The judge continued in her ruling, moreover, if the court reconciled the statutes in the manner suggested by the plaintiffs, it would defeat the purpose of the entire statutory scheme, which they were asking that all unused ballots, not just absentee and regular, all unused ballots be destroyed at 8 o'clock on election night. She concluded that numerous procedures are in place to ensure unused ballots are safeguarded after 8 p.m., and you know, we know that both from experience and you know, from the history in the in administering these elections and in entirely vote by mail for the last over a decade.
Okay, Mr. Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Mr. Trout has done such an excellent job that I have nothing to add other than to say that the Association of Oregon County Clerks supports the Dash 1 amendments of 2199. Thank you.
Questions for the panel? Representative Berger.
Mr. Trout, as I understand it, it is this data would be part of the certification process. In other words, it would be transmitted to you at the time before you certify the election from all counties. And you, is it your understanding that you could not certify the elections without this data?
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, that would be part of the certification requirements, and so, yes, we would need that report, which would be a public report prior to us being able to certify, which would be part of our additional 10 days to certify that election.
And follow up, because you've hit on the other thing, a public report, how would the public have mm-hmm. access to this data?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, it's a public record, and it's not a part of the security plan, which is kept confidential, and so you know, that could be accessed from the either from the county clerks or from our office, and if there was enough of an interest, I'm sure that we could you know, provide that on the web if there was interest.
Okay. One other question on this bill. H, the number and location of all security surveillance video cameras, that is just to be part of the security plan. It's a new addition to the security plan. Is that what that language is about? There is no more requirement that they have more security. It's just simply that they have to submit as part of their security plan where they are.
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, yes, it's a requirement for them to include in the security plan where their cameras are. We have directed and had compliance in all but one county to have security cameras present. So we currently have security cameras in 35 of the 36 counties. The one county where we don't have them is because the ballots are tallied and processed in the jury room. And so it's a small county, and we're trying to figure out a way to make sure that we can maintain security there and not threaten jury deliberations. But our intention also is to study and to add camera requirements here in the coming months after we do an evaluation of what the status of the current camera levels are in each of the counties.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The Dash 1 amendment, Mr. Chair, Dash 1 amendments, have you submitted those yet? Then I don't have them in my...
Mr. Chair, Representative Kennemer, yes.
Okay. Thank you. I probably have a question since part of the problem was in our county, but I'm not sure yet.
Did you want time to...
That's okay. You indicated that you wanted an amendment to talk about placement of the security cameras.
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kennemer, the amendment was to include, instead of simply stating that we had to see where the cameras were in the tally area, which is the current directive that we've given them to have cameras in the tally area, that this expands it to have them report cameras anywhere in the elections office not just in the tally room, so that we can see other areas such as ballot processing areas, storage areas, and the like, so that it's not limited to those tally, to where the tally happens, so that it's actually broader. And that's what we're investigating, whether we need more cameras in some of the counties on.
Okay. Representative Hicks.
The passage of law that you read was 254-483, paragraph 1, contained in our bill here on line 10 of the of page 2. And that's going to be stricken and replaced by lines 14 through 18. This is the first time I've looked at these dash 1 amendments, but it says in the dash 1 amendments, delete lines 15 through 18 of page 2.
That. Thank you very much.
So, how are you fixing the problem? Because if the dash 1 amendment deletes the language that's designed to fix the problem that you articulated, can you walk me through how this statute would work, please? Or
so,
somebody.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hicks, line 14 is the one that gets us where we need to go. Each county clerk is responsible for the safekeeping, disposition, and security of all ballots.
Oh. I mean, okay. And that tells them to do exactly what? Where do we find that in the law? What exactly are they statutorily required to do if we pass this with the dash 1 amendments?
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hicks, it's whatever the county's appropriate procedures are that would be part of our security plan or part of their general procedures as far as what to do with those unused ballots. And because we have such different diversity among the 36 counties, some small counties, you know, they put them in a box and they seal it. In Mr. Scott's county, you know, they have a room that they will lock them in and secure those ballots. He's going to need to secure them longer because his certification is going to take longer because he has more ballots to process rather than Sherman County, who's got 962 registered voters. It's not going to take them very long, and they're not going to have to keep all of the ballots on hand and secure for as long. And so they may destroy those at a sooner date, depending on their certification and any recount or challenges that may occur during that window.
I mean, what I'm discerning here is that if we pass the dash ones, there's not going to be a statutory description and certainly not a uniform requirement for what happens to unused ballots throughout the state of Oregon. It's going to be basically on each county clerk to figure it out.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hicks, yes, and that's the way it is today, and that's the way it has been for, you know, for a long, long time. Okay. You know, there are unique circumstances in each of the counties, and so that's why we want them to be responsible for maintaining and accounting and the security of the ballots, however it's best to do it in their circumstance and with the facilities that they have and whether they have a vault or not and whatever the unique circumstances of that county are.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you both very much.
Thanks.
We'll just take our witnesses in the order they signed up. Andrew Nisbet and Ruth Bendel.
Could we have Sharon Cornish because she's co-signed on the testimony?
Yeah, Sharon Corny? Cornish.
In addition to Ruth or instead of me?
You all three can sit down at once.
All three.
And go in whatever order you like. Please just identify yourself for the record.
Yeah. My name is Ruth Bendel, 10980 Southwest Muirwood Drive, Portland 97225. Until recently, I was the voter integrity chair for Washington County, and previously, I've also been voting integrity for the state for the Republican Party. I would like to say right from the very beginning that it was instilled in me from the years back when I started observing at the elections office that the golden rule was you don't have unused ballots around the elections office from the moment that the ballot count begins. And I think you should be aware that because we have vote by mail now, there are tens of thousands, particularly in the larger counties, of undeliverable ballots returned to the elections offices. And they come back already within you know, just a few days before the election. And I strongly oppose this whole bill because it doesn't respect the golden rule not to have unused ballots. All the elections offices are designed differently. They're parts of office buildings, shared space and everything. Not all of them have these locked facilities for putting the unused ballots in. And that is why I've referred you to the 2004 version of ORS 254.483, where it also mandates that all unused ballots get destroyed immediately after 8 o'clock on election evening. And I'll tell you that the simple solution is to follow the instructions from that bill, and I didn't attach it, but I told Zoe that I will scan it and have it with you. But basically, what we have coming into the elections offices to deal with the ballot handling are election board temporary hires. They sit, there's up to 25 tables of them, three to four at a table with a mix of Republican, Democrat, Independent at the tables. And the fact of the matter is that the law actually designates those temporary hires to be preparing and tabulating those unused ballots. And that law also stipulates that it includes all ballots relating to that election, because there's been a quibbling that the undeliverable ballots don't fall into the category of unused ballots. They are unused. They've never been seen or touched by the people to whom they were supposed to have been delivered. So they're there. And having them tabulated by the election boards when they are waiting for ballots to be brought back from the ballot drop sites or to arrive from the mail. I think you should be aware that in the week before election day, the percentage of ballots returned is pretty thin. More and more people are discovering the fact that their ballots can be opened as early as 7 days before the election. So guess what? They hold on to their ballots. So what do you get? You get 50 to 60% of ballots returned the day before the election or even on election day. That's when the hard work. So why not put these temporary hires that we, the taxpayer, are paying for, put them to work to get those ballots all tabulated and set aside, even set a percentage aside of each of them by, according to district, and have on that duplicate written so that the ballots that come in from the disabled who have ballots this size, those ballots can be duplicated by them, right? And so you don't have to have any unused ballots kept after 8 o'clock on election evening because you've rendered those people only for duplication point. And the rest of them, just after 8 o'clock, whatever's left in the office where ballots have been given out until 8 o'clock, those will quickly be ready for the shredding and have the shredder, because that's what happens. A shredder is supposed to come on election evening and shred the remainder of the unused ballots. I just want to say that the process that's being proposed in this bill, where for 40 days there are numerous unused ballots that could be exchanged during the course of doing the count and then the recount, because as ballots come in, we've got ballots from the military that can come in. We've got ballots that have been challenged for whatever reason that may not be added to the count. But when you've got as many, for instance, in 2010, when Chris Dudley was the candidate for governor, Chris Dudley had won the election even on the day after the election. He was declared the winner. And then, oops, we had this business that late coming ballots change the outcome. Do you know how many ballots were ultimately shredded in June of 2011? 70,000 just in Multnomah County alone. Why should we allow a situation which casts a real shadow of doubt on the integrity of the outcome? And whether you have cameras or not, with ballots sitting around for all of those days, it just puts the possibility or probability of exploitation into the hands of people. And, you know, on election evening, there are people running back and forth. So you've got boxes of ballots that have been counted, boxes of ballots still to be counted. And I heard when the excuse given to the judge when the mandamus action was done to demand compliance with ORS 254.483. What was the excuse given? It was that people were coming lined up, would be lined up and would be denied ballots after 8 o'clock in the evening. I can tell you what happens in Washington County. The front door is locked. Nobody can come in after 8 o'clock. People getting their ballots in the mail, if they're going to have any changes made, it's all done before 8 o'clock, and you are listening to somebody who is at the elections office in Washington County, and I know the people that are sitting elsewhere. So the fact of the matter is you don't need unused ballots. You can just adopt rules that give you ballots that you might need for duplication and get the rest of the ballots shredded and then leave no doubt in people's mind that the outcome is the legitimate outcome. And there is a lot of concern among people, growing concern. You've heard about it on the news. It's bad enough that we have an ability for these temporary hires to do what's known as enhancement, because you've got the undervotes that are there. I don't want to see undervotes exploited, but you're dealing now with the unused ballots. Please put them out of harm's way into the shredder. They can be recycled. And none of this business that somebody keeps a secret of how many ballots there are and where they're put. We deserve transparency, and we're not getting transparency. And what really annoyed me, I believe this is a nation of laws, but that the Secretary of State's office was telling the county clerks not to comply with ORS 254.483. And the wording is that shall. It's not may or can. It shall. What kind of laws and compliance with laws should people believe in if there's a Secretary of State and state officials telling county clerks to disregard a mandate? And a mandate that is there for good reason. I do hope that you reconsider this bill, take a good look at the ORS from 2004. You will have it later this afternoon. I'm sure you can even look it up for yourselves, but I will get it online. And just consider that the populace, the voters, deserve a whole lot better. Don't forget we had an immigration fraud back in 2003 uncovered, where people were registering to vote, and we've got dead people on the ballot that have managed post-mortem to get their vote in. So please, can we clean things up? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My name is Sharon Cornish. I'm from Washington County. I've been an observer of elections probably 35 years, not just once in a while, but every day, that election is going on. My concern with this issue is They don't clean the rolls. You wouldn't have all these non-deliverables sitting around if they, during the year, clean the rolls. What Ruth has said is absolutely true. We do not want to lose our observation. We had a hard time getting into Washington County under Mrs. Kingsley. We were put in a corner. We couldn't see anything. But we finally broke the ice. We went to county commissioners to get the unused ballots locked in a room. They built a room because of our testimony. But then we found out the unused ballots were locked up and the voted ballots weren't. So what's worse? Both. It's not being run safely, simply because elections aren't following the shall destroy law, 254-483. And we wouldn't have that many unused ballots if they did their work during the year and cleaned the rolls. I don't want any more secrecy. I want them to follow the law as is. And I want to feel that the election, after the fact, was true. I don't know. Even in being an observer for pickups at the drop sites, this one of these last elections, it took 3 hours for the ballots to get back from Forest Grove. And that's what Ruth says. Those people didn't have anything to do for 3 hours. We paid for that. I never got an answer of why. Never. I sat there waiting to observe for 3 hours because the pickups hadn't returned. We still don't know why. There's a lot of cleanup to do. And I'm sorry to say, but I think it's from Salem. And I think the locals are scared to death. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Nesbitt?
I'm Andrew Nesbitt, 1710 Southeast Belmont, Portland, Oregon. I've been an election observer for the Republican Party in Multnomah County for about the past 16 years. Whether you decide that the ballots are supposed to be stored, counted, and then destroyed at a later date, or destroyed on the eve of the election, it's well to consider that, at least in Multnomah County, and I have a very limited set of expertise that I wouldn't want to expand outside of the stuff I actually have seen and watched, you're talking about a tremendous amount of paper. We had all of the returned ballots in the last election. They had, after they had dealt with duplicates, dealt with replacements, dealt with damaged ballots, they still had over 26,000 unused ballots in addition to the ballots that had been returned as undeliverable. That's a lot of paper. It's going to take a lot of handling. It's going to take a lot of counting and a lot of shredding to be able to deal with it, and I think you should probably keep that in mind. In Multnomah County, the ballots are not printed by the county. They are printed by a private vendor. The private vendor, you clearly need a section to distinguish between the number of ballots printed, the number of ballots that are actually delivered to the county. Now, if I were running things, I would probably have the ballots printed by a private vendor, but the fact that they're being printed by a private vendor does make the system somewhat less transparent for those of us who spend our time trying to observe it. And as this section, the security plan, is in this section of the law, if I were writing security plans, I would probably upset Ruth, and I would have them be confidential as well, because telling people exactly how you are protecting a procedure is not something you want to do in advance. But I don't actually see any good reason why the security plans should remain confidential. Once the election is over, we, as observers of the election and as the public, should have access to the procedures that were in place to secure the election, and after some reasonable point prior to the submission of the next security plan, on the date the election is certified, after a year, but at some point the plans need to become public so that we who have an obligation to watch the process can be assured that a reasonable security process was in place. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee.
I appreciate your testimony. Thank you. Appreciate questions? All right. Thank you, all three of you. We have four more folks. Let's have Patrick Glasswell and Janice Deisinger, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Patrick Glasswell, 4625 North Montana, Portland, Oregon. I am the Multnomah County Chair of Voter Integrity Project. My concern is the video, the element of the video. There is no specified duration of storage. Without that, we could be storing video for an hour or a week or a year. There is no standard given. Without that standard, as the person who's responsible for obtaining all of that video for the Republican Party, I don't know how soon. Do I need to be downloading every day? How much time do I have to bother Tim? Tim has been very, very accommodating in providing the video, but he only had to do it with a download of 3 terabytes and only had to fill up 2 very large hard drives so far. The state law does not require availability of the video to members of the public, as far as I can tell. That needs to be in the law, the transparency of the video and when the video is available. In my mind, as the person who showed up all the time, I saw no reason why the video shouldn't have been available every day, or for that matter, why my own data storage system couldn't have been in place during the election as a backup if the party was willing to pay for that. So having a video portion of the plan without a requirement for storage accommodations is pointless. Also, it would be very, very useful if the state was to implement a audit of our security procedures by an outside nonpartisan vendor. Something like the Core Group or one of the other organizations. While I'm not recommending at this time an actual penetration test, certainly an audit of our security procedures would be of benefit because while I've secured things up to and including a 2-man team going into Iraq for consulting and participated in nuclear weapons security, I'm not expert in everything. And there is limitation to any person's knowledge. Bringing in some experts would be of value to voter security. Thank you. Are there any questions?
We'll take Ms. Deisinger's testimony first, and then we'll see if there are questions.
Hi, I'm Janice Deisinger. Thank you for allowing me to come today, Chair and Vice Chair and members. I was a participant in the lawsuit this last year, and I was very reluctant to be part of that lawsuit, but I just didn't feel that there was any other alternative to assure of election integrity without going forward with it. So this this issue has gone through five bills and a lawsuit over the last several years, and it's very concerning to the public to not have confidence in their elections. So my goal is that we can solve this problem and come up with some reasonable security and some reasonable transparency that the people can have confidence in their election. So Mr. Bucall has given me a memo, and you have a copy of all of that, and that goes over several issues within this bill, and I think they are very appropriate. It tightens the safety. I agree with Mr. Nesbitt and Mr. Laswell's take on the security. We definitely need electronic security. It's not anywhere in the law. And since we're going to more and more electronic types of devices, we have another bill later that we'll discuss on signature verification process. And all of these systems are only as good as the people who write them. And those people, we all hope, are open and transparent for their motives, but we won't know unless we test some of that. So we need some testing within the law that we can be give us some confidence about the process. And then the treatment of the duplicate ballots, I also agree with Mr. Bucall on. What Mr. Nesbitt said about the security, I also agree on it. Mr. Bucall gave a formula for how the ballots were to add up at the end of the certification process. There's a number of ballots that were required to know the numbers of, but we don't know how they are to relate to each other. So he gives a formula for how to know whether those are done properly, and I thought that was very good. So I wanted to also recommend that if you might consider, since this has been such a debated issue, that you might consider making this a measure to put before the people and let them put their input, their decision-making process in place, so that we aren't badgering back and forth between the legislature and lawsuits and all. But if you could propose a bill that would the proponents of this bill would offer, and then a second one that would be more similar to what Mr. Bucall has put forward here, that might give the community an opportunity to really make an input into the process. And a third measure that I might suggest that you put out, it would be for changing the way that we treat the ballots when they come in, and that would be to not do enhancements on the ballots, but just to bring them in as some states do, open them up and count them, and not do all of the enhancement processes. Either way, there'll be problems with some ballots that their ballots might be marked in a way that makes the computer not read them right. But there's also the problem on the other side where people feel that their ballots might be enhanced and changed. So either way, and let the people decide whether they want which way they want to go on it, and that would offer a more confidence in the process. And I would just make those suggestions. I included in my electronic packet to you a copy of the lawsuit and a copy of Mr. McCulloch's report that he gave on the electronic security at the elections office a couple of years ago, so that you'll have that to review. And I thank you very much for taking the time. Thank you.
We appreciate your testimony. Thank you. Mm-hmm. See no questions, so that's all. Thanks. Final two witnesses are Sandy Radu and Cappy Eaton.
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, for the record, Cappy Eaton with the League of Women Voters of Oregon. For over 93 years now, we've been very much concerned about elections and voters' rights, and the ballot. And we believe that citizens are entitled to elections where every effort is made to preserve ballot secrecy in order to prevent fraud. The vote-by-mail system has worked well, and the provisions for security and secrecy in the proposed legislation will enhance it. We have worked with you with these issues for two or three sessions now, trying to get a bill which satisfies as many of the citizens and the legislature as possible. We believe this is a good bill, and we urge you to pass it.
Ms. Radu?
Chair Garrett, Vice Chairs, members, thank you for hearing. My name is Sandy Radu. I'm from Beaverton, Oregon, and I am the brand newly appointed Republican Party State Voter Integrity Chair. So as that, this is my first official, so be patient.
Welcome.
Thank you. I think we all agree that the public has a right to know that their vote is respected and properly counted. I don't think anyone in this room would disagree with that statement. But every ballot that is counted improperly or that may be submitted fraudulently or erroneously does disenfranchise a legitimate voter. Since vote-by-mail was adopted in 1998, Statute 454 has been amended, rewritten, amended, and amended again, and amended again, and quite often has changed so many times that it's now reduced to what I consider bad law. We've seen an example of that today. We've heard about the ambiguities just in the destruction of the ballots. Some rules can't be interpreted at all by a judge or by anybody. I'd like to see, eventually, these statutes rewritten regarding the printing, mailing, and handling of all blank ballots, including unmailed and returned, and all the rules regarding handling of the voted ballots, so that we can remove inconsistencies that have been holdovers from the old procedure. We'd like to see these changes in the rules and the procedures, helping to ensure a sound election process and remove any doubt of the integrity of the process. Specifically with this bill, what I would like to see is, coming from an engineering background, the numbers can make sense. And if we have the number of ballots that are printed available to those who want to observe and see what's going on, that be made available prior to the mailing of any ballots. Then when we know how many ballots have been mailed out, we can tally how many ballots have been received back and how many have been undeliverable and have a good feel for where we are. Of course, we won't have final numbers until the certification of election. What I've said in my testimony is that I would like to see item J, the number, items A and B, be made public at the time of the printing of the ballots. Those are the items, the number of ballots printed and the number of ballots mailed. Then on election day, it would be, we could have, at 8 o'clock on election day, we could have the number issued by the office, handed out as duplicates and so on. We would have the count of the undeliverable ballots, the numbers that are rejected, and the numbers that are tallied. Now, obviously, we won't have the tallies until a little bit later, but we would have those on election day or very shortly thereafter. And then we can get amendments to those items as well as items G, H, and I made available upon certification. But this would allow observers to have some level of confidence that the ballot numbers add up. For example, if we're told that there's 10,000 ballots that are unused and we're looking at 12 or 14 pallets of undeliverable ballots, those numbers don't add up. We would like some assurance that we're at least in the ballpark. By election day, each county clerk should know approximately how many blank ballots they will need for the enhancement and duplication process based on historical knowledge as well as items that they've pulled out of the tallies on the ongoing basis. It seems that they could keep all but, you know, this number plus a percentage for reserves for the duplication enhancement process and destroy all the rest of them as soon as possible, preferably on election day, maybe not 8 p.m., but by midnight. Also, in addition, the emergency clause of this bill prevents citizens from pursuing an initiative to require destruction of the ballots and other type of ballot handling. Whether this should be referred to the voters or not, I do not know. It's not necessarily to me to determine, but it seems that this might be a misuse of the emergency clause, and I would like the the group to reconsider that to us. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Berger.
Yeah, just one comment. I'm not unmindful of what you're trying to do here. The number of ballots printed, however, is tricky. The number ordered from the printer is less tricky. I used to be a printer, and you order, send a ton more than is ordered, because if you're short, you're dead.
I would agree with that.
And printing, but you have some good language in here, and it says election night adds up within a reasonable margin. Of course, what that reasonable margin would be is a trickier thing to put in statute, but I just wanted to get on the record as a printer that just saying X number was printed doesn't mean X number was printed.
You're absolutely right.
From a printer's point of view, it's this minimum was printed and some number over. Otherwise, you don't stay in business very long.
Thank you.
There are always overages.
Thank you.
Or your customer comes back and you debt. So just protecting the printers a little bit here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for your testimony. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2199. And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2739. Ms. Seiler, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2739 adjusts hours of business for county clerk on election days, renames card issued to voters upon registration or updates registration to voter notification card, and allows Secretary of State to approve automated system for county clerks to use verification for verifying signatures of voters cast. You have a dash one amendment. It removes the provision allowing Secretary of State to approve automated system for county clerks to use to verify signatures of voters who cast ballots, and changes requirement in election statutes that election-related documents be filed with the county clerk or other filing officer from 5 p.m. to the new language, close of business.
Tim Scott, and we'll just start with Mr. Scott.
Chair Garrett, members of the committee. The Association of County, I'm Tim Scott, Legislative Chair for Association of Oregon County Clerks. And this is one of the two bills that the association put forward this legislative session. And this bill, or the dash one amendments of this bill, do three things essentially. The first two are related to hours of the clerk's office. And the third is related to voter notification cards. Addressing the first issue related to the hours on election day, currently the statute requires that all Oregon election offices are open from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. And that's statewide. And what some of the rural counties are finding is that essentially since vote by mail was passed, they don't have a single voter that comes in from 7 to 8 a.m. And this relates to all election days, regardless of whether there's 300 voters involved in that election or whether it's a countywide. So the clerks have put forward this this provision to try to address sort of the complexity of requiring a one-size-fits-all solution when some counties clearly don't need that hour to serve voters. But the bill does not require that. It doesn't say that we can't be open earlier than that, and there are several counties, including Multnomah County, that would continue to be open at 7. I have a line at my door at 7 a.m., while Baker County generally doesn't. So this would give some flexibility to the rural counties that don't necessarily have the demand from voters on election day that some of the urban counties do. The second provision in this bill, in the dash ones, is actually related to the filing deadlines. There are a lot of places in the statutes that talk about 5 p.m. deadlines. This has become problematic for counties who have by financial necessity, decrease the hours of that their offices are open to the public. I know one of the counties that I spoke to is Lane County, and They are now on a, I think, 8-4 or 8-4:30 schedule, which makes it difficult for them to comply with 5 p.m. deadlines. The deadlines that we're talking about here are essentially filing deadlines, which are filing officer specific. I was going to say county specific, but since the state is a filing officer as well, it would be all counties and the state. But if you're going to be a candidate in Multnomah County, you've got to file with Multnomah County. If you're going to be a state candidate, you've got to file with the state. So being that those locations are specific, we don't feel that changing the deadline to close of business would essentially provide an opportunity for one person to get service in another county when that county is open, when another county is closed. Since the paperwork must be filed in a specific location and that location advertises their hours. All of the counties do a good job of advertising the hours that are open, especially when there are changes to those hours necessitated in some cases by financial distress. The third provision is related to voter notification cards, and actually the statute currently calls them confirmation cards. I brought with me a voter notification card. It's actually Representative Dembrose. I figured he wouldn't mind me if anyone wants to take a look at this. But it's just a card that we send to the voter when they take some action with us. Usually it's when they register to vote or change their address or update any information that they have in their record. And we also are required to send these confirmation cards now whenever we make a change to precinct lines. And having just come out of the redistricting process in Multnomah County, we had to change a lot of lines. And the idea behind the voter notification card is they get a confirmation from us that we have taken the action that they requested, especially with a new voter registration or a change of address, something like that. But essentially, since we've moved to vote by mail, and this card does not now notify you of where to vote, since your ballot is being mailed to your address, the change related to the precinct is essentially unnecessary. You're still going to get your ballot at your house or at your mailing address, whether we send the card or not. And what we found in the last redistricting process is this card actually generated more questions from voters than it did answer them. In Multnomah County, we changed all of our precincts and mailed to every single one of our voters, and we had to bring in extra help for about a week to answer the phone calls from people saying, why did I get this card, even though we printed on the card, you're getting this card because of redistricting, nothing's changed. So it's also expensive. We came up with a per card cost statewide. If every county mailed to every voter in the state at about a cost of about 15 cents a card, it comes out to about $300,000 statewide. Now, every county does not mail to every voter. Some counties do it selectively because they don't change all of their precincts. Certain counties need to make changes more often than others. But it is expensive. And it, you know, by giving us the option to not send the card, especially for a precinct change, would help with costs. And I'll answer any questions if you have them.
So this just takes it from mandatory to permissive?
Chair Garrett, yes. Right. It's just permissive.
Okay. Questions for this group? Representative Hicks.
Just so, like, I don't know, 8.5 out of 10 pages on this bill apply to the concealed carry.
Yes.
And I don't know. So if this may sound apparent, but I mean, you know, the relating to clause is very narrow, I think. And so,
are you trying to make this a gun bill, Representative?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm getting. I mean, is there any way this could become a gun bill? With, I mean, we pass it, it goes off wherever it goes, then suddenly it's controversial.
Relating to elections procedures, I don't think this can become a gun bill.
What's that? Sorry, no, Representative.
Oh. So, what's your question?
Oh, it could. Oh, Ms. Seiler, what do you think?
Does this have anything to do with concealed carry permits? Or could it possibly, could someone amend this thing to change it down the line? If we let this bill go out, is it going to be subsequently possibly amended to have something to do with concealed carry permits?
Related to clause would allow that.
I don't see how that's possible.
Well, it's important just to nail that down. Because okay. Thank you.
Representative Berger.
I had the same problem as Representative Hicks. I'm looking through 10 pages, and I'm looking for that section that allows for reducing the time that the polls were open. Wasn't that where you started, that it's a reduction in the... Where is it?
Section 1 of the original bill.
Section 1 on the first page. Section 1, it says, okay, there it is, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. I admit to having a little concern with this because even in those small counties where it's kind of expensive, there's an expectation that you're going to be open, and I'm worried about folks, how we would inform people that it's not going to be open that hour. You know, I people feel disenfranchised. They got up, they went, they felt they needed to go, and they went because it's always been open and the door is closed. Is there any notification in there so people... I mean, I understand what we're trying to do here, but I'm a little bothered by the no money argument when you change something as fundamental as the expectation that they're going to walk in and be, have access to this. This is a really important thing to people.
Chair Garrett,
particularly those people that get up at 7 in the morning and want to be there at 7:05.
Chair Garrett, Representative Berger, I understand your concern. And the clerks would not be opposed to adding something that would give some sort of requirement for notification. Currently, though, there's several medium available for advertising hours, including every county has a website where the county clerk's office has their hours posted. Most counties in the Valley do press releases to talk about hours on Election Day. The state also has their drop site locator, as well as links to, so if you go into My Vote on the Secretary of State's website, to plug that a little bit, you can find out who your clerk is, what hours the office is open. They also list all the locations of all the drop boxes and the hours of those drop boxes as well. So there's lots of avenues for people to get the information. But again, I don't think we would be opposed to adding some sort of notification requirement if we could flesh that out.
Is there a further question?
No, I'm just thinking.
Okay. Representative Holby?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually went through the same thought process of does staying open between 7 and 8, you know, provide a benefit to everybody? And what kind of businesses actually happens in today's world of vote by mail? And what do voters come in for in those hours on the day of election?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, it could be anything, you know. If for whatever reason they don't feel like they can, you know, cast their ballot any other way than by dropping it at the elections office, we get some of that. They didn't receive their ballot in the mail because maybe they moved and need to update their address and get a new ballot. The dog ate it, literally. We get that quite often. You know, anything that would require them to get a new ballot at that point. We recently did a survey during the 2012 general election, just of people standing in line at my office, because despite what happens in Washington County, we do have people standing in line at my office, and they
predominantly said they either didn't get their ballot or they spoiled their ballot in some way. Overwhelmingly, those were the two main reasons, and they were there to get a replacement.
Thanks.
Representative Dembro.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So just to kind of clarify, it's still going to be up to the individual county. I mean, if their voters, if for them the office being closed from 7 to 8 is a real problem, they can go to their county clerk and request that it be kept open longer. Is that correct?
Chair Garrett, Representative Dembro, yes. I mean, certainly I would listen to feedback from my voters. I can't speak from all the other counties, but you know, we basically try to be open as much as possible to serve the needs of our voters. For Multnomah County, that has a positive effect on our work processes. If we're open the Saturday before the election, every one of those people who comes in on Saturday doesn't come in on Tuesday. But we have the demand. In some of the counties, like I said, they've relayed to me that they haven't seen voters in that hour in years, but certainly it's permissive.
Yeah, just add, it seems to me that if it's permissive, I don't really have a problem with it, because you can still have the local variation depending on what people need.
Representative Berger.
Permissive or not, I see this as a way for counties to cut costs, and they will use it based on that, not on the needs of voters. And I have a problem with it.
Okay. Well, I think we can continue that discussion. But thank you, Mr. Scott, for your testimony.
Thank you.
Let's call Andrew Nisbet, Janice Deisinger, and Sandy Radu, please.
Mr. Chairman, Committee, Andrew Nesbitt, 1710 Southeast Belmont, Portland, Oregon. I was actually, when I was reading through this and suddenly found that Sections 5 and 6 were about concealed carry laws, I was suddenly struck by a feeling of horror that 3 months from now I'm going to discover that I really, really wanted to read the Sections 5 and 6 that were about election law, and that they are hiding out there in a fog bank waiting for me. But that is probably merely random paranoia on my part. It turns out that the section that I hate with a fiery passion, which is Section 7, allowing for an automated signature verification process, has already been stricken. I hate this enough that I want to waste some of your time explaining to you exactly how hateful it is in hopes that it will be buried in a crossroads and we will never see it again. It provides us with a complete elimination of transparency in the signature verification process. If it is made HALVA compliant, it locks us into a specific set of software with incredibly onerous conditions to ever change this should problems develop. It has an unknown amount of costs, and I will say that computerizing systems in the state of Oregon are not world famous for coming in under cost. It is in every respect hateful, loathsome. I'm glad it's dead, and I hope you keep it dead. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we are clear on your position.
But how do you?
I could tell you what I really think.
Ms. Deisinger.
Hi, I'm Janice Deisinger, 32235 Southeast Pipeline Road in Gresham, Oregon, and I am also glad to hear that that section is gone, because that was my main concern. But in the process, I thought I would bring to your attention that voter registration cards provide the signature for our verification. And I don't know if you're aware of it, but a person can have more than one signature on file which is used to verify your ballot when it comes in. And I became very frustrated one time when I was observing this up in Multnomah County, and one of the cards was signed, "Do not count this ballot, it is fraud," for the signature line. And no notary would ever consider that to be a valid signature. So maybe we could have some revision somewhere where they talk about the signatures that would require that a person actually sign their given name instead of letting it be some other happy face or something that would give doubt to the validity of the person's signature. And that I'll just say I agree with Andrew very much.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Radu.
Sandy Radu, Beaverton, Oregon, and I would also like to say I agree with Andrew wholeheartedly, and as 30 years in software quality and software quality analysis, I can also agree from that point of view that if there is a bug in the system, it will become very evident and could be extremely painful to fix the process during an election. So I thank you very much for striking that.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you to the panel. We have one more. Henry Kramer from the Bus Project, please.
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Henry Kramer, represent the Oregon Bus Project. We engage young people and new people in democracy, and we're opposed to House Bill 2739 as currently written, particularly the shrinking of office hours. We share Representative Berger's concerns. We're also really sympathetic to the clerk's concerns. They have really hard jobs and really tight budgets, and we understand where they're coming from. We're really grateful for what they do. But removing an hour of access hurts working Oregonians' ability to exercise their right and responsibility to vote, plain and simple. Particularly, this would curtail access to the ballot for working parents, for people working multiple jobs, for people who have to be somewhere between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m., but might have that 7 to 8 slot open, sometimes the only hour they have. Otherwise, elections offices are open from 8 to 5 or 8 to 4:30, which coincide with from Monday through Friday, which are business hours. Those are times people are working if they're doing the thing we want them to be doing. That 7 to 8 slot is necessary for them. At the bus, we've made hundreds of thousands of nonpartisan get-out-the-vote phone calls, mostly to young, unlikely voters, and it's not uncommon. I've had these conversations myself, calling up folks, hearing that they didn't get their ballot for whatever reason, or they spilled red wine on their ballot and don't know what to do. These things happen. And it's an interesting back and forth. You say, well, you didn't get your ballot. Well, you know, you can actually go down to the elections office and get a new ballot and vote right there. And they say, oh, I didn't know that. We say, well, you can go down. Do you have time tomorrow? And they'll say, no, I have an 8 a.m. class. Say, well, it's actually open at 7. They say, great, I'll go down right then. We shouldn't take away that right for them. To Mr. Scott's point that some counties will keep doing this, I believe him. I trust Tim Scott. To be frank, I adore Tim Scott. I think everybody should be Tim Scott. But every count, we have 60 counties in Oregon. Voters in each of those counties should have the same right to vote as voters in every other county. To make this different county by county would potentially disenfranchise some voters, particularly in those rural counties. So we discourage having the capacity for different voting standards in different counties. Otherwise, we think this is a good bill. We'd support passage so long as the hours reduction were taken out. And thank you very much for the opportunity to speak before you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thanks, Henry.
Thank you.
Representative Holby, sorry.
Thank you. Just a comment. You know, I think I actually agree with the testifier that the 7 o'clock is important to a lot of people. I think the intent of the bill, though, is, you know, more around government efficiency and, you know, trying to control our costs. And I certainly would still support the change in the Dash 1 amendment that refers to the close of business day that aren't critical to the election day hours, because I think that does really help counties control costs. And most of those early closes I don't see as being so egregious to the voting public is impacting their ability to vote. It's mostly a process for counties because several counties, including my own, are really strapped for cash and trying to provide, you know, the function of elections is one of their most important functions. And how do they do this efficiently without the support from the you know, of revenue across the state to keep their doors open. So I applaud the counties for trying to come up with a way. I think the Dash 1 amendment is something we should consider. I'm not sure that we should go forward with the 7 a.m. idea, or doing away with 7 a.m., I should say.
Okay, we're not working this bill today, so we have some time to figure out exactly how we want to proceed, but I think you did make some good points, and appreciate your testimony.
Thanks very much.
We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2739. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3113. Justin Black and Janice Deisinger are our two witnesses. Ms. Seiler?
And members, House Bill 3113 eliminates requirement that statements regarding measures authorizing bonds or certain taxes to be printed on envelopes in which ballots titles are delivered, eliminates requirement that ballot title for measure authorizing local option taxes contain certain additional statements. There is an emergency clause on this measure. This measure does have a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. I have had a chance to talk to the Legislative Fiscal Office. They don't believe it has a fiscal impact, but that can be addressed when we have additional hearings on this matter.
Mr. Black?
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, Justin Black from the Oregon Education Association. We worked with the Revenue Committee to bring this forward based on our ever-increasing activity on local bond and local levy measures and trying to fund schools. And two things arose was the current requirement that ballots that are on a local operating levy require this statement on the outside that contains vote on proposed tax increase or that it contains a vote on renewal of a current local option taxes. And our members really approach this as, why is this requirement only on local operating levies and nothing else? If we're voting on candidates, shouldn't there be something on the outside of the ballot saying, vote on candidates? It seems a little odd that we are just pulling out local operating levies for this requirement, so that's why we come forward with the striking that part out. The second part of the bill requires in the ballot title a quotation that this measure may cause property taxes to increase more than 3%. I think those of you that have been following the compression problem on local property taxes and also the fact that in a lot of cases this statement just isn't right. It may be more than 3%, but in a lot of times it's a lot less than 3%. Other parts of the statute already require that the ballot title include the start of the levy, the duration of the levy, and how much per thousand is already going to be in the levy. So all of the impacts are already required in the statement, and this part of the statement just seems to be a little extra for no I wasn't around when it was introduced. So I guess I can't say why it was in there. And I will stop with that. We really like this bill. We think it's a great idea. We would just like to see a little more continuity in how local bond measures do their bond ballot titles and the outside of the ballot. So here we go.
Thank you. Ms. Deisinger.
Thank you, Chair Carrot and members. I just wanted to say I know that the elections officials are all about increasing voter participation, and by having a statement on the outside of the envelope that it contains a possible tax increase encourages a lot of people to vote. So I would just encourage you to keep it there. I think it people are expecting it to be there if they're going to be receiving a tax increase. If they don't work if they don't participate in the election. So I think it really encourages that, and I would ask you to keep it.
All right. Thank you. Questions for either these witnesses? I guess not. Thank you both. Okay. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3113, and that does have a subsequent referral, so we need to figure out what's going to happen there since there's no evident fiscal. Final bill is House Bill 3344. Open a public hearing, and Representative Hoyle is going to start us off.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3344 deletes provisions relating to confidentiality of challenged ballots, directs the state to adopt rules to protect identities of persons whose ballots have been challenged, directs county clerks to distribute upon request and subject to rules adopted by the secretary list of persons whose ballots have been challenged.
Representative Hoyle.
Chair Garrett, members of the committee. Today I'd like to talk to you about why
identify yourself for the record.
Oh, Val Hoyle, represent House District 14, West Eugene and Junction City. I'd like to talk to you about why I'm supporting House Bill 3344. When a voter's ballot has an incorrect signature or a problem or an issue, it's called a challenge ballot. The voters are notified within are notified that their ballot has issues, and they have 10 days to correct the problem and get the ballot back. Currently, that list of voters is of challenge ballots is not public record, and it's unfortunately the only part of the election system that is not transparent. In every election, there are thousands of challenged ballots. The hope is that this bill would direct county clerks to make sure that this list of voters can be made public while making sure that their actual votes are not revealed and remain confidential. So we're planning to work further with the Secretary of State, Kate Brown's office, to make sure this bill meets all of its intended goals, but everything else within the election process is open to public, is public, and we would like to see the challenge ballot list be public as well.
Thank you.
Just
Representative Kenner. Yes.
Sure, I was listening. My apologies.
Oh, it's okay.
So you want the names of people with challenged ballots to be public?
That's right. Just in the same way that, you know, we get the list, whether it's, you know, any member of the public can go in and get a list of who has voted and who hasn't voted. So, you know, you go to your county elections office and they will give you that, and you get the matchbacks, you know, during the election back. But what we don't have is we don't have a list of those challenged ballots. We don't have a list of what ballots are out there. So.
So a challenged ballot would be on the list of not yet voted, correct?
It would be on the list of not yet voted.
So you know who's voted and you know who hasn't voted, and a challenge would be a subset of those who have not voted. I guess I'm having trouble why that should be information of importance to the public.
I think it's information of importance to the public, regardless of what party you're in. We work to ensure that we can contact voters, give them the help that they need. Getting the ballot back within 10 days, letting people know that, hey, you've got a challenge ballot. I mean, I've had, because I signed my name in different ways, I've certainly had ballots come back. And when you have people that are busy, that are working, we would want to make sure, just like we can contact people who haven't voted, to remind them to get their ballot in, talking people through the process of getting a different ballot or returning their ballot. Again, why should these ballots, which are a subset, which require something different than just getting your first initial ballot in, why should this not be public?
Right. Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
I would answer that question that it's not the public's business that you're having trouble. You've voted or you've not voted, and the transaction in there is between you and the clerk, not you and the public, I guess is my feeling about that. But I, you know, maybe I'm just not getting it.
Representative Barnhart and then Representative Kenner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My daughter had this particular situation arise because when she first signed a voter card, she was 18, and when she was being challenged, she was 23, and a lot had happened in the meantime through her signature, through nobody's fault, just the way things are. And she told me that she'd received a postcard, I think, from the elections office, and I said, well, you hightail yourself down there and fill out a new voter card so that they have your correct signature. And she did, and I presume her votes were counted. I think the point of making this list public is this. People who have turned in a ballot have evidenced an intention to vote.
Yes.
They want to vote. They did the things that you normally do in order to vote. But there's a glitch, and the glitch apparently in this case, I think, is if it's a challenge and it has to do with the signature, is that the signature they use now isn't being recognized as there's a comparison with the voter registration card. My daughter got help from me to get her card updated because she asked me about it. I think the point of this is that this would allow those who are interested in working in an election to make certain that those who want to vote actually can and actually do will have the opportunity to provide that assistance that I provided for my daughter.
Representative Kenemer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I go back to Representative Berger's comment. I also think this has the potential to identify and embarrass voters, because obviously something is wrong. And I think that's counterintuitive in my view of how we try to set up our voting system to work.
Chair Garrett, Representative Kenemer, I appreciate that sentiment. However, I don't think in general, and again, having had a ballot returned, that it was necessarily something that was, it doesn't state why the ballot was incorrect, but just that it is a challenged ballot. And I do think that if we want, and again, regardless of what party you're in, regardless of what district you're in, regardless of what area we're in, we want to ensure that more people participate in the process. And again, having a challenged ballot, and I think Representative Barnhart said it very well, these people have indicated that they are interested in voting, that they would like their vote to count, and anything that we can do to help ensure that their vote counts, I think we should do, but I certainly understand your sentiment.
Representative
Berger. One other point here, and he just hit on it, what's bothering me about this. One of the knocks on mail-in ballots has always been the coercion factor. Somebody can get to you and coerce you into voting a certain way in your own, you know, you're not in a private voting booth, you're somewhere else. And it's, I can remember the arguments about, well, husbands will be telling wives or wives will be telling husbands at the kitchen table how they should vote. This is the coercion factor. And I think that's what bothers me about this. You have someone who has a problem, a challenge, and it not only stigmatizes them in some sense, as he mentions, but it also, oh, well, I'm a partisan person and I'm going to call up this person and make sure they vote, and it smacks of a coercion piece. I'm going to go through the roles of the Democrats who have had challenge ballots and make sure they get theirs in, and somebody else is going to go through the roles of the Republicans who have challenge ballots and make sure they get in. And that, in my mind, the transaction is between the clerk and the person who's had a challenge, and I'm really uncomfortable with this notion, and I'm sorry, I know it doesn't feel like that to you, but it definitely feels that way to me, and I think I've hit on what's really bugging me, that coercion factor.
Representative, do you want to respond?
Not that Representative Barnhart would be coercing his daughter in any way, shape, or form.
Or anyone.
Or anyone.
Representative Kenemer has a question, but you want to take a minute to respond.
Chair Garrett, yeah. Representative Berger, I appreciate your sentiment, I can certainly understand that. Having voted in my, you know, until I moved to Oregon, in a ballot booth, in a private ballot booth, I can tell you that there's lots of ways to coerce people and for people to feel pressured in terms of a vote. But in this particular instance, and I do appreciate what you're saying, I think the aid and assistance you can give someone who really wants to have their voice heard weighs in favor of supporting this type of legislation. But again, I completely understand where you're coming from.
Representative Denbrough.
Thank you. I think Representative Hoyle made this point, but it's hard for me to see how this is any more coercive than the phone calls that we make when we see that somebody hasn't voted yet. Mm-hmm. You know, if somebody hasn't voted, we call them to remind them to vote. You know, in this case, we would be calling someone and reminding them to get their corrected ballot in, or, you know, to go in and take care of this this challenge problem. My sense also in terms of the stigma is You know, the great majority, as I understand it, of challenge ballots do have to do with a signature problem. So, you know, I'm not sure that there's really a stigma attached to it. You know, it's either a signature problem or maybe there was a, you know, an address problem. But actually, the only ones I can think of are the signature problems, which is not a poor stigma. You know, I mean, these things have, it's happened to me as well.
Yeah. Chair Garrett, Representative Dembrough, I think that's exactly right. And also, the type of call would be different as opposed to calling saying, get your ballot in, and someone saying, well, actually, I got my ballot in. I'm not sure what the problem is, which, again, I'm speaking from personal experience, as opposed to saying, were you aware that you have a challenge ballot? Did you get notified? Do you need any information or assistance in terms of going in and dealing with a challenge ballot? It is actually a different type of contact. So.
All right. I think you're off the hot seat. Thank you, sure. Representative. We have three witnesses. We'll just bring you all up at once. Tim Scott, Janice Deisinger, and Sandy Radu, please. You were first on the list, so why don't you go ahead, Mr. Scott.
Sure. Chair Garrett, members of the committee, my name is Tim Scott, representing Oregon Association of County Clerks today. I'd like to first answer Representative Berger's question. A challenge ballot shows as returned because it has been returned. So on the voted, not voted list, it shows as voted.
It does make a difference.
That makes a big difference.
Makes a difference.
So the clerks had a few points that that they'd like me to bring up, and we oppose this bill as written, mainly because of sort of the integrity of the process that we have been entrusted with by the voter in terms of handling their ballot once it's returned. When a signature challenge occurs, we have 10 days from the date that we challenge the ballot, or we have 3 days from the date that we challenge the ballot to get a letter out to the voter. And that's done in an equitable manner, whether it's someone didn't sign their ballot or there's a non-matching signature or something like that. Everyone in that category of challenge is sent the same letter within the same time frame, and they have until 10 days after the election to respond to that challenge. But for the most part, what we're talking about is signature challenges, non-matching signature or no signature on the ballot. That's the by far the majority of challenges that we have. And currently that list is confidential. This ensures that the only correspondence that the elector receives about their ballot is from us. That message is consistent and goes directly to the voter. The Clerks Association feels that there's an expectation of privacy and confidentiality in the process. If 3344 passes, voters whose signatures challenge, that expectation might be lost. If anyone could buy the list and contact the voters, it could lead to inequitable contact by parties that have a specific interest in how that election's going. And the topic of close races came up, and this does happen even in Multnomah County, even though not as often in some other counties. And we've had races that were separated by only 6 or 7 votes in as recent as the last election. And since the reporting is continuous from the time we start giving out results reports, anyone who's following that can go from report to report and see that, you know, two votes was counted in that race today, and those votes went this way. And there's always challenge ballots out there that play into that. So taking that a step further, down the road, you could see that if that list was public and there were 24 ballots out there that were challenged and a seven vote margin, and you had political party information associated with the voter's ballot, there is potential for, I'm not going to use that word, but there is potential for fraud. So for these reasons, the association would like to be the only person contacting the voter for that purpose. And we have been in discussions with the Secretary of State's office on compromise language around this topic, but that's about all where we've gotten right now. And I'll answer any questions that you have.
All right, thank you very much for that testimony. Why don't we finish the panel and we'll go to questions. Ms., whoever wants to go next.
Thank you. I'm Janice Deisinger, 32235 Southeast Pipeline Road, Gresham, Oregon. And I've raised my voice many times in opposition to a bill. I just wanted to, when I was in favor of one, I wanted to thank you for it. If for some reason that you determine that that you want to not go forward with this bill, and could you possibly consider that at some time later, after the ballots had been counted, that this list would be made available so we can keep track if there are a problem? Maybe this would allow for some sunshine on to the voter rolls, and just would appreciate having more information available to the public is better. If it compromises it for having a particular vote and during the counting process, then maybe just make it available later, but the list would still be available.
Sandy Radue, Beaverton, Oregon. I would like to just ask the members of the committee here to consider how many challenged ballots remain after certification of an election. What the percentage of them is being fixed before the election as opposed to after. Because I know I have a letter here from my son where his signature was challenged, but his vote was counted, even though he didn't do anything about it. He was asked to fix it later. But I'm sure there's a lot of people that get the other letter where it is challenged and they don't get counted, but they may not be able to get in for whatever reason. If that percentage is large, I would advise you to please pass this bill. If it is not, then if it's a very small percentage that isn't taking care of it now, then maybe it's not a good bill. I personally am in favor of it because I would like every person that thinks they voted to have their vote counted. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for, yes, Representative Berger.
Yeah. I agree with this, folks, that it would be useful to know how many ballots are challenged and what percentage in that reporting thing at the end after the ballots. But knowing individual who those people are specifically, I think, is real bothersome to me. But knowing the number of challenged ballots during an election and how many were resolved in what way, I think would be of interest. I am not opposed to the sunshine. It's what the clerk said that scares me to death, that at some tight elections this could come down to. It also, a challenge ballot to some says, oh, there's a problem with the signatures. To others it says, oh, you're cheating. And there's the stigma of you're being challenged by the clerk because you're doing something of a nefarious nature. And that's one of the problems with list of names, just because your signature's wrong. But then there might be something of a nefarious nature that causes your ballot to be challenged too.
Representative Kenemer.
Yes, thank you, Ms. Scott. I wondered, do you have any off-the-hand information about how many are resolved prior to the election or what percentage afterwards or whatever, and some general numbers for us?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kenemer, I don't have those numbers off the top of my head, but I believe the Democratic Party of Oregon did a public records request prior to the 2012 election, asking county clerks for that information. I know my office has provided it to the Democratic Party of Oregon in the past, and it is available. It is a record that we could provide.
Next time you're in that office of the DPO, Representative Kenemer, you can get that information. Representative Denbrough, did you have a question? All right. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I
hope I'm understanding this correctly, but it seems to me that if these lists are available, that it's a fairly strong, powerful campaign tool. Well, if they're available and they haven't, if they've been challenged, and they happen to be of the right political party, which you can also check, it's very possible then for one to make sure that all your good Republican constituents who have been challenged are advised and helped, as Representative Barnhart was doing for his daughter in another context, helped through the maze of getting and ensuring that their ballots are going to count. Obviously, it's a bipartisan sort of thing. It's just who has the time and energy and money to wants to, you know, invest it in this way. The thing, and my concern with it is, I applaud the Secretary of State's office. I applaud the efforts that we make here in Oregon. The efforts that have been made in America to try to get people to vote. We'll be seeing other bills in this session trying to get people to vote, making it easier for them. I think one bill coming now where we can register at 16. And you know, all of these are good efforts with a laudable cause, I mean, sort of thing. The thing, however, that I find as I campaign around in my district, and I know it's very different than most of your districts, but, you know, be that as it may, many of my constituents are getting kind of irritated about people harassing them, their terminology, about voting. And I wonder if some of these things are not potentially counterproductive to the process, to the sanctity of the process. And I'm not making a statement, I'm trying to make a statement con, I'm just telling you what my concern, you know, might be with this, and I would, I know we're not working the bill today, and we'll have, people will have plenty of opportunity to enlighten me along the way before we get to working the bill, so.
I'd like to hear back from you about your discussions with the Secretary of State's office before we decide how to proceed. Mr. Scott, you said you're sure. Working on language with them?
Yeah.
Representative Hoyle?
Yeah. Mr. Scott, I just have one question. So if a ballot is challenged and the person doesn't get their ballot back, is the voter then listed as inactive, and do they have to go in, or do they get their ballot in the next election?
Representative Garrett, Representative Hoyle, if someone does not respond to our notification, they are inactivated, but then they are also notified that they have been inactivated. We cannot take that step without notifying them. So first they get a letter saying we've challenged your signature, and hopefully they take the opportunity to update. But if they don't respond, then we do inactivate them. But all they would need to do is send us a new registration card with an updated signature, and we would reactivate them, just the same as anyone else who was inactive.
So that actually happened to me, and I had no idea that I wasn't registered, and I didn't know why people were coming to my door asking me to register to vote when I said, but I'm registered. and it was, again, at a challenge ballot. I was traveling because I used to travel for work for 3-4 weeks at a time, and so that is also an issue. And I know that our county clerk in Lane County does an exceptional job of reaching out and contacting people, but again, I think that this is one more reason why if we can have those names public, just again, like we do when we know whether people turn in ballots or didn't turn in ballots, I think it would be helpful. But again, thank you so much.
Ms. Radu, you had another comment?
I have two comments, actually. If we did not have vote by mail, but we were voting at a polling place and the signature was challenged, it would be challenged on the spot, and the person would have an opportunity immediately to fix it. There would be an immediate feedback. And I think that giving them one more chance via phone call, whoever makes the phone call, might be an opportune thing for them to not have their vote thrown in the trash can if they're traveling or something like that, let alone their registration. The other thing is, in the close elections like Mr. Scott referred to, wouldn't you want all those votes counted so that you made sure that it was an absolutely positively perfect election count? And that's all I have.
Okay. Thank you very much. I think we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3344. And that concludes our business for the day. Committee's adjourned.